FCO, NTDO 212, complex.
DPS, go. Inco, go. PUS, go. Surgeon, go. Booster, go. Copy that, we have a go from you guys.
This is Talking Sound.
Sheriff, I know what you're thinking. How is it that two outstanding gentlemen, handsome and well-hung such as ourselves, would end up in a place with all these ugly scoundrels?
I know all of you.
Parasites, leeches, scum feeding off scum.
Any of you see me take this money?
It's right there in your hand.
You think you supersede the law?
Look, we can have nicknames. I could be Lawless Luke Young. Or what about Lusty Luke Young?
Can you show me where your bedroom is?
Cochino.
Huh?
How about Loudmouth Luke?
Well, hello, ladies and gentlemen.
I kind of like that, too.
Welcome to the Talking Sound Podcast. I am Chris Jordan, your host. Coming to you from Austin, Texas, you are listening to the audio from the official trailer for the first season of the series Death and Compromise from producer, writer, director, actor Brian Elder and, excuse me, Dr. John Hall as well. It's a serial Western show that is looking to be really fantastic, amazingly well done, and shot right here in Texas. Joining us today, once again, is Brian Elder, the writer, director, and producer of the series. Welcome to the show there, Brian. How are you today?
Doing great, Chris. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, you are very, very welcome. Please do pardon the roughness of my voice. As I told you earlier, we have a little bit of a summer cold going on here in the house. So you were supposed to be in studio today. Instead, you are live via phone.
That's okay. Like the rough voice is always like really cool, right? Like I love it. Like when I first wake up, my voice is like, hey, how's it going?
Hey.
Good, you know?
Yeah. Yeah,
yeah.
Somebody bring me a voice of God microphone.
Yeah, where's my guns at today?
They really just shot all of the Batman footage first thing in the morning. That was all a Christian right. Bale shooting. Was like first 30 minutes after he woke up.
He goes, I'm Batman.
Yeah.
And can I get some coffee? Oh, shooting's over for the day. All right, tomorrow.
Guys,
we'll pick
seriously,
up right
I'm trying to act. Stop.
Yes, exactly.
So right. Well, yeah, I've heard he's a pill on set, but he's also one of those that's like, dude, he's like a De Niro. Like, you know, you look at stuff like The Machinist, where it was like, yeah, let me go lose 60 pounds for this film.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And then go gain that plus more back to do Batman so I can be svelte and ripped and learn martial arts. Like, I remember he had a doctor on set for both of those to make sure that, like, he lost and regained the weight in a healthy way.
Yeah, like, yeah. Yes, you have to. You have to. Because if not, that can be really bad. But, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
No, he's a great, great actor, though.
Well, and,
great actor.
And that's what we want to get into today is not necessarily Christian Bale and Batman and his acting skills, but writing, producing, directing, finding those right actors, finding those right people to play the parts, getting the takes that you want, making a series, the breadth of Death and Compromise. How does that begin? I guess let's start out with a little bit of your story, Brian, if you could share with us how it is that you got into the medium of film to begin with.
So I come from a musical background. So I was a musician for many years, and that was like my strongest thing. It was like my passion. I loved it. I was a singer, songwriter, and guitar player. And from there, I kind of fell into the acting stuff where I got to be on set. Like, long story short, I got to be on a really cool set. It was actually, it was To Have an Hole was the first one I was on for 5 days. But the one that got me hooked was right after that. I got on the Spielberg set, Lincoln. I'm from Virginia originally. They were filming out there. Yeah, and I was on that for like, I think like 2 or 3 weeks I worked on that one. I worked on for like a week, I think, of training or something like that, where we had to train with muskets and learning how to fight with them and learning how to do fist-to-fist combat and just all that sort of stuff with film. And that was really the first thing that I ever really did, like where I was like trying to, you know, do anything with it. And it's just like, I don't know, like just being, you know, in the costume and like that. And that's where my love for character acting comes from, because like just being in the costumes and being able to do all that stuff and being on the set and learning and stuff. And just, that's what hooked me. I was like, after that was done, it was like a bittersweet day when they were like, that's a wrap, we're done. You know, it was, cause I got to work on the very last day as well. And it was just a bittersweet moment. Cause it was just like, oh, it's done. Cause it was freezing cold outside in Virginia when we finished in December. But it was like, I loved every single moment of it. And then like getting, you know, just going back, I was like, oh my gosh, where could I do this at more, you know? And so that's what got me hooked and into the film stuff, was just that. And I love so much character acting. I love, you know, being different characters and getting into costumes and stuff and those types of things. So that was like my turning point for me, where I was like, this is what I got to do. So,
yeah. And what was it that brought you eventually to writing and to being behind the lens as a director?
So the writing thing just happened. Like I said, I'm a singer-songwriter, so I'd written, you know, songs and all that stuff. And to me, that's kind of, you know, depending on what type of music you write or what kind of style you write as far as, like, lyrically, but a lot of times it's basically you're writing a story within a song. It's just, it's in a song, you know, form. And so that was the thing that I always still enjoyed. But I like telling stories and everything. I like being able to get creative and you know, just put new things out there. And I remember as a child, like watching TV, and you'd see like all these adventure movies, like, you know, Goonies and Indiana Jones and things like that. And that was like, for me, I loved watching those things because it took you on an adventure. So you like, for the next 2 hours, I mean, you're nowhere. You are somewhere completely different, just watching this TV screen or movie theater screen or whatever you're watching it on. And you're inside the movie, or for me at least, that's what it was for me. It was like, I was in this movie and I'm like watching this thing. And so it's like, and I mean, I had no interest in, I wasn't even chasing acting at the time. It was just, that's how I felt when I watched those things. And so that was something that I wanted to do, was like tell stories and adventures and creative stuff. And so it just, you know, and you can create things your own these days, you know, where there's like, there's not that, you know, not always that middleman you have to go through now, like it was back in the days. You had to go to the studios and get them to do this and that and stuff. And so it was kind of an outlet for me to be like, okay, cool. I can create my own characters by writing and acting them. And then, you know, I'm also doing the storytelling thing, which I love. And, so that's what got me into the writing. And then the directing is the same thing. Like, you're the creative process. When you direct, it's your vision you have to get across to that screen. I mean, you have to be creative. You have to know what you want out of it. You have to know what you need from the characters, and you have to be able to do all that stuff. And that was still like the creative process, the creative side of me that was like, okay, this is fun too. I love directing as well, because I like interacting with the actors, whether I'm in a scene with them acting or whether I'm like directing them, and I get to like, you know, put them in the situation. Like, okay, this is where you're at right now. This is what, you know, I mean, this is what's happening to you, and you know, all that. So it's the creative side that really got me into both sides. And I love film. I love being on a film set. I absolutely love it. I'm not above to do, but somebody calls me and they're like, you know, hey, do you want a PA on this set? And I'm like, yeah, let's do it. You know, so I'll go PA on the set. I mean, which is production assistant, you know, and I just love being on a set, you know. But that's the most fun for me, is the creative process and the acting part of it.
But yeah, it is definitely a giddy thrill. People ask me all the time, because, you know, especially in the live end of the industry, you meet a lot of curmudgeons. Whenever you go into, like, you meet a lot of salty sound engineers whenever you go into clubs, you know. Yeah. You meet a lot of salty cameramen in studios.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff. Whatever. You don't know what you're doing. And I'm like, I don't grasp that. I just don't get it. I'm getting paid to play with people's expensive toys. Like,
yeah, exactly.
How can you possibly be angry about any part of this situation that you're involved in?
I don't get it either. I remember we were doing Lincoln. It was, like I said, it was the first thing, but we were in knee-deep water and mud in November, freezing cold. I remember hearing people complain about that. Like other actors, they were just like, oh, when are we going to wrap? This is cold. I'm like, dude, when you were like 10 years old, you were playing in the mud, in the water, in the freezing cold in Virginia. You didn't care about it.
Yeah.
I'm like, you're a child right now, and you're getting paid for this thing, you know, to be able to do this and be an emotion major. You know what I mean? I don't get it either, Chris.
Yeah.
I don't understand, man.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You know, that reminds me of the old SNL skit of the sketch that they did of James Cameron directing Titanic, where it was like,
oh, yeah.
And it was really cold in the water. But when James said, add more water, he was right. We needed more water.
I'm going to have to look that up now.
Oh, it's,
now I want to watch
it's
that. That's
absolutely
great.
Hilarious. It's so great. You know, just like one of those, like, oh, yeah. Classy
oh,
stuff.
That's awesome.
But that is very much what happens on a film set. It's very, you know,
yeah.
It's kind of like the dirty secrets of what happened. Like, you hear an album all the time, but the dirty secrets of what happened in that studio while that album was being produced. Totally different.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the stories of the songwriting on the road, the way that things came together. And that's what I'd like you to share a little bit right now with the audience about Death and Compromise. How is it that you and your creative partner in this venture, John Hall, came to know each other? And where did the idea for Death and Compromise really come about? When did the spark happen, and when did life really get to start filling the sails of this project?
So, and it's been a long process. We've been working on this thing, so it's definitely been taking us a little while. But we met, I don't remember the year that we met or like when it was. I know we've known each other for quite a few years now. I'm going to say maybe, I'm going to shoot out there maybe 5 years or 5.5 years, 6 years,
okay,
something like
yeah.
that we've known each other for. And so we met actually at a SAG Awards, the Acting Guild Union. They were having a viewing party here in Austin. And I went, I was with some friends. He went, he was with some friends. Him and I didn't know each other at the time. But we met that night, so we also had mutual friends, and you know, everybody was there pretty much. And so John at the time was trying to, he had a book that was out, and I know he had done some interviews with you about the book, I believe. And so he had the book that was out,
yeah, yeah.
And he wanted to turn it into a film and wanted to do a trailer for it, basically. And so he was reaching out to people, you know, just, you know, for different production companies and trying to get people on board to do this. And I actually had a production company at the time with four other partners. And so we were doing commercials and we were doing short films and our own stuff, as well as things that people would hire us for and everything. So we got introduced to a mutual friend of ours that was just like, hey, you know, John Hall, you got to meet Brian Elder. He's got a production company. John Hall needs, you know, a trailer shot. And so, you know, you guys meet, exchange numbers and all that. And so we did. And so, so we really didn't talk then too much. We talked and hung out, but we, you know, we were there for the viewing of the SAG Awards. And so that's where we met. And then, he contacted us through our Facebook page and, you know, arranged the whole thing. And we went there, we shot the trailer for him. You know, I did the editing and that sort of stuff on it. And Benny had, you know, I mean, we all hit it off, you know, and became friends. And then like, he had other things he had going on. You know, we talked earlier before we started recording everything about John had a band. He comes from a musical background just like I do. And mm-hmm. so he had a band at the time still, which I think he still does. I don't mean like still, like he doesn't now, but he had a band and he needed some music videos. And so we started doing those for him. So we shot, I want to say like 5 music videos for him.
Oh, wow.
Something like that. Yeah. So, and they're all on YouTube and different places you can find them and stuff. But yeah, so we shot 5 different music videos for him. And we just, through the whole process of just, you know, shooting the music videos and just, you know, being around each other, we all became really close friends. And we just became really close. And so we were actually, and so as far as Devin Compromise, we were actually on a one of his music video sets. It was, which one was it? I think it was Take That Ride, I think. I could be telling you wrong. No, it was, oh God, I gotta remember which one it was. I don't remember the title of it, but it's Thick Chorus Rodeo, and it was the name of the band. And it was, it wasn't Take That Ride, because we did that one in a different place. But anyways, we shot a music video for him, and on this music video set, we were at a place called The Settlement, 1850 Settlement, and where they have a lot of historic stuff, like structures still there, just a few things, not much. And, but it's a historical place, and they still hold weddings there and all that sort of stuff. And at the time I was getting ready to shoot a feature film, and, it was one of my films I was writing. And, I put that on hold, you know, for now, obviously because of what I'm about to tell you, but like, I have always wanted to shoot a Western, like always wanted to do one, just because, you know, the whole Indiana Jones, the Star Wars thing and stuff, to me, those are, you know, the adventure West thing, you know. Yeah. So, you know, and then, you know, two of my favorite movies, you know, two of my favorite Western movies were like Young Guns and Tombstone.
Yeah.
You know? And so that was like, and those again were the same type of thing. They were like adventure type movies. They took you on the whole ride. And so like, yeah. I've always wanted to shoot a Western, and, you know, come to find out John is a, you know, fanatic for Westerns too. He loves the whole, mm-hmm. like, you know, Josie Wales with Clint Eastwood and all that. And I mean, we're both a huge fan of Clint Eastwood, you know, directing or writing or acting. And so I was running around this place like a child, basically. And I was like, oh my gosh, this place is awesome. This is so cool. And I was mentioning, I always wanted to shoot a Western, and, you know, I really want to shoot a Western. And then a guy was, that owned the place, he was a friend of John's, and he was like, well, we got a cellar and everything, so you want to check the cellar out. And so, you know, we were just like, yeah. So he took us down in the cellar. The cellar was awesome. And it just sparked so many ideas, and things were just happening. And I was like, oh my gosh, it's so awesome. I was like, I'm going to write a Western. I'm going to write a Western. I'm going to shoot a Western. And, you know, and John was like, he looked at me, he was like, yeah, he's like, I think we should. He was like, once you write a Western, he was like, put us both in there as lead characters, which is, you know, who Luke and Lynn are. And he was like, you know, he's like, you know, I'll fund it and we'll get it off the ground. And I was like, yeah, let's do it. So I went home and I wrote an entire, it started off as a short film that I wanted to make into a feature, but we're going to shoot just the short film part of it. So I went home and wrote the entire short film. And then John and I got talking, and, you know, we were like, you know, why don't we just do a series instead? And so I took the short film that was like 15 pages and flipped that into 23 pages. And, for like a pilot. And, you know, we did that. And then, right after that, we were getting ready. You know, we did all the whole pre-production stuff and all that, but I brought a friend in. I got to give him a shout out too. I brought a friend in, you know, that I didn't know at the time, but now as a friend, we brought him on, through a mutual friend of mine that had mentioned him and was like, hey, he's a writer. You should, you know, talk to him as well. And he's like, send him your script. And I was like, yeah, absolutely. So he sent him the script, Jeremiah Olsman. He called me. He was like, dude, I love this. And this is only like the second thing I'd ever written script wise in my entire life. So, you know, I was still like learning all the things and stuff. And he was like, dude, he's like, I love the script. Like, it's great. He was like, you know, I love the chemistry between Luke and Lem. I like how, you know, that whole thing is just, he said, it's great. He said, I'd like to come on and punch up some of the dialogue if you want. And I was like, yeah, absolutely. So he came on and he, you know, between him and I, you know, we punched it up, and I mean, he did wonders, you know, helping me with that. And we just, I mean, from then, it's just been like, we went to pre-production, did that. And, you know, I mean, John and I have just become like, you know, he's one of my best friends. So we became really close, and, you know, me, him and his wife, we hang out, and, you know, I know his wife's family, and, you know, I was the best man at their wedding, and just, you know, we just became best friends, became really, really close. And, it's been a lot of work putting this thing together and doing it, but it's been a great experience. I mean, it's been amazing. It's been wonderful. And, you know, I mean, both of us, you know, we both now, we love our characters, and, you know, it's just, it's been a great journey. So that's how it pretty much came about. And, you know, we had to do 2, 3, 4. We only shot just the one, but, we had to move on with 2, 3, and 4 because, John had met somebody that was, had a Roku channel, up and coming Roku channel. And he met them, and he was like, you know, he called me. He's like, Brian's like, I got an interview for us, or a meeting with us for this guy, Jake at this Roku channel, Grand Network. And so we're gonna meet him at dinner and stuff like that. And so we met with him, and we talked to him about it, and he saw the trailer that we had at the time, and he loved it. And he was like, all right, he's like, I want to put it on the channel, but I need like at least 4 episodes. And we were like, okay, we need to start writing 3 episodes.
Exactly.
So even
as a podcast, with my podcast network, we do a podcast boot camp, and I recommend you have at least 3 episodes before you release. Quite a few services, like iTunes, won't let you join without 3 episodes. The many services will not let you join, and that's something to consider, folks out there that are wanting to either start up a podcast or start your own episodic series. There's the concept of the binge that so many of these services like Netflix and Hulu and Roku have picked up on. The fact that people want to get to know you real quick, you know?
Yeah.
Because many of us know, like my wife and I, we have a hard 3-episode rule in our house. Whenever we go to check out a new series, it's one of those, we'll give it 3 episodes. We're willing to lose 3 hours of our life and never, ever right. get it back. Because, hey, the first one's a pilot, you know?
Yeah.
That's what you're selling the show on. And, hey, sometimes character names change. Sometimes a little bit of the plot changes between the first and the second episode. Sometimes, like, the camera work totally changes.
Yeah.
Like, the production value sometimes is like double what the first episode was, because sometimes you'll watch something and go like, oh man, that's like somebody just shot their high school play. Like, ooh, that's rough.
Right.
You know, like, put the S video cameras away. And then suddenly the second episode you're like, whoa. What happened? That's because the first episode is a pilot, folks. They're shooting that, like he's saying, to get funding, to find other people who are interested in investing in the project.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and that's the thing, too. It's like each episode, you know, even with ours, but like with anything, you know, if you watch the first episode, and I've noticed this for me, too, if I'm watching a series on Netflix or whatever, the first episode, sometimes, like at the end of it, they have a small cliffhanger, you know.
Yeah.
But it's like after the pilot, and you're just kind of like, okay, you know, you're thinking to yourself, yeah, I kind of want to see what's next, but I don't really care too much. But I mean, not that you don't care, but you want to see it little tiny bit. But then you watch the second one, and it's kind of another, you know, another moment where it's like, okay, well now I kind of want to see episode 3. But by the time you get to the third or fourth one, that's how long it takes you to get hooked. And you're just like, oh, I want to know what happens. And every single one of them after that, you want to know more, because now you're invested in the characters by the third episode.
Well, and you know, a prime example of them, I'm busy watching Breaking Bad for like the 5th time right now. We just restarted it just as background stuff. And, you know, that's one of those that the character of Walter White just grabs you from the get-go. How do you go about as a writer, as a creator, creating that character? Because that's it, that really to me is what's key. My wife uses the concept of comedy in the fact that a character must be redeemable. There must there must be some redeemable quality in there that endears you to the person and makes you care for them throughout a sketch. You know, that when things go bad, you're like, oh my God. And it's comedy, so things are going to go bad. That's where the comedy comes from. How do you go about creating that persona that draws somebody in? What are you looking for to put on the screen to attract people, to pull them into the screen and into the story?
It could be a number of different things, really. Like, one thing is you always want to make your characters, you know, for me, I mean, like, you know, everybody's got their own thing they do, and everything works. It's just a matter of, you know, how you do it and all that stuff. But like, for me personally, like, I like to make my characters kind of relatable to people. So that way it's like, you know, either you can see yourself as that character, like in the fact that, you know, you're like, oh yeah, you know, I got some of these same qualities, or, everybody is for comedy. Everybody loves the funny guy or the funny girl. Everybody loves that. So even in real life, if you can be hilarious in real life and you can make people laugh, people want to be around you. Same thing on the screen. You know, if you make people laugh, that character, people want to, you know, they want to be around that character and stuff. And so, and the other thing is, like, if they're not relatable, you know, I like to make them, make characters where it's like people maybe not personally be relate to them, but they want to be like them in a way. So it's like, yeah, I mean, I'm gonna shoot back to Star Wars. You know, think about that. Like, what kid did not go, oh man, I want to be Luke Skywalker so bad, or I want to be Han Solo? You know, especially, I mean, that's like the thing. It's like, now you're drawn into that. You know, for me, again, this is just my, you know, thought of it, my process or my concept is like, now you're drawn into it, because now you're like, oh, I want to be that character. You know, and even if you don't do acting, everybody is like, I mean, that's just a human trait, I think. Is like,
yeah, the commonality.
Like, oh, you know? Yeah. So that's one thing. And like, you know, and one thing I've learned to, you know, that you can draw people, like pretty quick is you always want to put your protagonist in a bad situation at the very beginning. Because if you put your protagonist in a bad situation at the very beginning, and then people want to know what's happening. If you make your character likable and you put him in a bad situation, and then you take him out of that and go, wait, let's just take you back here and tell you what's happening first. That's a good hook. And I do that with some of my films. I have, you know, a couple of feature films that I'm currently working on. One of them is a horror film. Well, I wouldn't even say the horror film. It's a thriller. And that's the first thing I do is I have something bad happening. And then before it gets too bad, I'm like, nope, not going to tell you what happens here. Hang on a minute. Let me show you what led up to that. And a lot of movies do that, you know, or a lot of series even do that, like the flashback or whatever. And, you know, and that's a good hook for people, because then if you just dangle that over and go, this isn't bad. Oh, hold on. Can't show you the carrot yet.
You could always go with the good old Game of Thrones carrot. And spoiler alert, folks, main character dies really early, like really early.
That's a pretty good catch.
All it does is keep you going like, well, damn, who the hell else are they going to kill? Like,
right?
if the dude that we're supposed to give a crap about just got killed, good God, nobody's sacred.
Yeah.
And That was the hook for many seasons on end. Was like, good God, who else are they going to kill in horrible ways?
Yeah, exactly. Or another hook, like, you know, with something like Jaws or whatever, where you like you show something going across the screen, but then like, you know, you know it's a shark, but you're not going to see it yet. So you kind of, it's that anticipation of the seeing it.
Yeah.
So you're right. There's so many different ways you can do it.
Well, and one of the things that goes so intimately into those moments, for people like yourself, for people like myself, and especially for directors, is the music, is the soundtracking. The music that goes into Death and Compromise is very well done. How do you go about, as a director, looking for the proper music? There are many of us out there, I'm sure you as a musician yourself, I myself as an electronic musician have always been like, dude, that'd be sweet to have my music in a movie. What are you looking for as a director when you're looking for music for your films, your projects, your series, like Death and Compromise?
So for this one, I've got to definitely give a shout out to Christian Tristan. He is an amazing composer. He was really great. Great. He was just, you know, very easy to work with as well. Like, I mean, you know, I'm one of those type of people that, you know, and even my sound design person, you know, Robbie Cluck, he was just great. He did Foley, did sound design, and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, they were just amazing to work with. They were just very, very, very great. I mean, very thankful, very, you know, humble. And it's like, and I'm one of the type of people that, you know, they'll send me something. And then, you know, I have to watch it and review it and go, okay, well, can we change this? Can we fix this? Can we add this? Can we take this out? Can we do whatever, you know? And not once did either one of them to, you know, complain, you know, even if it was like, you know, they sent me a whole track and we made revisions twice, you know, we made revisions here and then they sent me back. And then I was like, well, it's, that's it. It's getting better. Let's do this. And then they send it back. Never once did they complain. So, you know, that's, you know, amazing. Cause it's the same thing as like being an actor. And I'm just giving them shout outs and I'll tell you how, you know, they did really, just really well. But like, you know, even as an actor, like when someone's directing you, you know, you're like if I'm doing something and I'm working on someone else's set, they're directing me and stuff. I mean, it's like, they're making revisions to us as well because they're being like, let's try it this way instead, you know, and you don't complain because you're doing what you love to do. So
yeah,
hands down, shout out to Christian Tristan, amazing, amazing, amazing composer. So, so great to work with. I will recommend him and work with him anytime. Same thing with Robbie Cluck. But so basically just getting a composer to do it and it's all like, that's all original composing. All of that is his original score, his original composing. So he composed every single bit of that, the trailer, all four episodes and the whole thing. And he nailed it. I mean, there wasn't a ton of revisions. There were certain things that, you know, I had to, you know, go in and be like, you know, can we fix this or change this or whatever? But it wasn't like it was a ton of revisions or anything. He nailed it. And all I had to do was tell him, you know, when we first talked, I was just like, you know, here's what I'm looking for. And, I was like, I don't necessarily want, cliche Western, you know, movie or like, you know, score in there. You know, we don't have to break out the banjos and, you know, and do all that. So I don't necessarily want that in there.
Yeah. We don't need to go bluegrass. Why.
Yes. Yeah. And there's reasons why I don't, you know, one, that wasn't really in my vision, but also two, like there's not, I wanted something different. Because, you know, if you start thinking outside the box and you start getting different with things, that's when people start noticing what you're doing. And people start going, oh, like Quentin Tarantino, he thinks outside the box and people start noticing his stuff. You know, and so if you just follow the crowd, you're not going to get noticed. And that's a thing. And so, like, I wanted to step outside of that and be like, okay, I don't want cliche Western music. I want something, you know, and I gave him the concept of like, you know, I mean, think like, you know, Pirates of the Caribbean, Indiana Jones, like, they're period pieces basically, but they aren't like period piece music that's with them. They're like adventurous music, and that's what I wanted, the adventure in it. And this kid nailed it. I mean, he was a great, great composer, you know, and you know, I mean, he knew exactly what I was going. I was just like, this is what, you know, I want. Like, I want an adventure felt thing, and I just, you know, some comedy in there, but it's not spaghetti Western comedy, you know, and he ran with it, and he was amazing. I mean, really, really great. I highly recommend Christian Tristan. Really do. He's great.
Yeah, it was, it really did transport you as you watched it. And like you said, it was not your atypical Western music. Whenever you watch the trailer, it's very, very well done, very poignantly placed as well, within the piece itself. Long did it take y'all to, number one, produce the sizzler, the first episode, the pilot episode? And how long did it take you to produce the other three, once you found a channel to start distributing them?
So the whole process from basically beginning to end, and there's reasons why it took a little longer. And actually, honestly, it didn't really take us that long because, you know, a lot of what I've been on these film festivals and stuff, and John and I have gone out to these things, like people are always talking about how long it takes them to do things. And there was one series that they turned into a feature film. And people were like, they're like, yeah, it took us 6 years to make this thing, and, you know, and to where they are now. And then I just went to a premiere not that long ago, like last weekend, I got invited to a premiere for a feature film that they did. And it was so well shot. It was really, really great. The acting was good. It was amazing. The whole thing was awesome. And the director was talking about how it took them, they wrote the thing in 2013. They started filming in 2015. They filmed for 25 days. And then consecutive days, they had like 6 days on, 1 day off. And they didn't release it until the very end of last year. And then as far as film festivals, and they got it into, viewing this year, just that, you know, that was one of the first premieres that they did. He said he had done 30 though. So it was on the same circuit of that premiere. And, you know, he mentioned it took us 3 years in post-production to get this thing, you know, get this thing done. So, you know, hearing that, and then we've actually, you know, so I don't feel as bad, but you know, we hear that a lot. And so it's like, cause at first I was thinking, well, man, like cause everything else I ever shot was like, I always got it done quick. And it was like, you know, music videos. It was like, bam, the next day I was editing and I was done. I was like, here you go, John, here's the music video. Here's that commercial, you know, for whoever we're working for. Here's my trailer for this feature film. And I had things done right away, like really quick and all that. But it was a little bit different because, you know, this is also a period piece, and it's super hard to, you know, it takes a lot more work to do a period piece. And then there was more components, and it was an entire feature film, basically, essentially, with, you know, running time of like an hour and 45 minutes with all four episodes. And so it's like, it took us a little more time, but we started in August of 2016, I want to say, I think, because it's August. Will be 3 years. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
16.
Wow.
So this August will be 3 years. We've been, we started with episode one. But at the same time we shot episode one in 5 days. And then we went into post-production. I started editing. At the time I had a full-time job, and I was doing, you know, and John works full-time too. And I was the only editor at the time. And so, you know, I was pretty much doing everything. I was editing and doing, you know, my own sound design and my own, all that stuff. And, you know, and it was a nightmare between like doing all of that, by myself, and then doing it between, you know, working and all that sort of stuff. And so, you know, but we had time because that's all we were doing was episode one. And then, I mean, I think it was like probably, John might remember more than me, but I think it was like, maybe 3, 4, 5, 6 months later or something like that, after we finished filming, that we got in contact, John had reached out to this Roku channel for Grand Network. So there was like five, six months or something like that, I think it was, that, you know, we weren't doing anything really other than, you know, just me trying to get this done during my downtime. And I created three different trailers and stuff like that. And so it was just a lot of that. And so 6 months of that, we really didn't have anything going on. And then when John got in touch with them, then it was like, you know, it was like a month or two where we had to go, okay, we got to get back to the drawing board. Now we have three episodes, you know, we got to create.
Yeah.
So, and then that takes time too. We had to write three episodes, you know, and that took us, you know, after that 2 or 3 months after talking to them, I mean, it took us, you know, I mean, probably another 2 or 3 months to flesh out, you know, three scripts, you know, I mean, like probably 2 months or something like that. So that was like an entire year that we had off basically. So, you know, we were working for those 2 years, with still some time off between those as well. But like, so in reality, we put it all together. We've really been working on it for like a year and a half, probably half of that 3 years we've actually been working on it. But the process was, it was long because of that. And it was a great learning experience, and it was, you know, just so much fun. And now I had people come on where I was like, you know, where I had my friend James Janda, which is, he lives in Seattle. He's a good friend of mine, great editor. We also had Allie Holland, who lives in Austin, another friend of mine, great editor as well. And, you know, I was able to bring them on and be like, you know, I can't do it on my own. I couldn't handle it. There's too much to do on my own. And so, I mean, cause you look at post-production credits and it's like, you know, 300 people working just post-production on a film.
Yeah. Yeah. So, no, that's like, it, that's three quarters of the work. It is not the people on set. Like,
yeah,
you actually want to like minimize the number of people on set.
Yes. Yeah. Well, it's like, it's just like, you know, going back to like Lincoln, I mean, we wrapped in December, and then it didn't hit theater until the following December. And they were supposed to show in November, I think it was, hit the release, I think is what I was reading or something, but they pushed it to December. That's a year of post-production with a whole production house of like hundreds of people working on this post-production. So yeah, you're right. I mean, it's a lot of work in post-production. That's the bulk of it right there is post-production.
Yeah.
You know, you have Foley work and sound design and color grading, and, you know, you have editing, and then you have, you know, ADR if you need it. And then you have people doing dialogue replacement, you know, just cleaning up the dialogue alone as you know, a team. And then you have, you know, someone scoring it. And then you have all the post supervisor managers, you know, just like, you know, looking over each department before the director even looks at it. And it's a lot of people working on set. So, but yeah.
How many?
That's the part that people don't see.
well, and how many people did you average throughout the production of Death and Compromise?
Oh, we had a big team. We actually had a really big team on set. We had, probably crew wise, we had about anywhere from like 30, 40, 50 people on crew. And that's just our crew and cast, our main crew and cast. That's not, you know, all the background that we had at certain times, and things like that. So, I mean, with background, there were some days where we actually brought on about 25, 30 people for background. And, about 25, I guess about 20, 30 people, something like that for certain days. And so, I mean, we probably had a crew and cast, between episode 1, 2, 3, 4 and our pickup shots and everything, we probably had, and post-production, we probably have a little over 100 cast and crew, including background that worked on this thing.
Wow.
So it was a pretty big, yeah, it was a pretty big thing. Cause not everybody that was in episode 1, you know, was in episode 2, 3, 4, you know, due to scheduling and, you know, just, you know, things like that. And then we back did pickup shots, you know, I know our DP for 1 was not available, so we had to get somebody else. But he was someone that did work on the set. He worked as an AC, so we just moved him up for second unit DP. And so it was like, you know, there was a lot of that going on too, where we had to, you know, bring new people in just to kind of help and stuff whenever someone was scheduled, and they can be like, you know, I can be there those 2 days, I can't be there those 3, or vice versa or whatever. So we had a pretty big cast and crew. Pretty big, so. And it was fun.
And it does take a long time to make any vision come to life, whether it's being a musician, producing an album in the studio, what have you. What has it been like for you to have, number one, finished what is now officially correct, the first season of Death and Compromise?
Oh, man, for me, it's been giving up my life. So it's like I just, I've put a lot of my social life aside for the last 3 years to get out of all of it. But, you know, I mean, you know, this has been my primary focus, you know. So it's like, you know, it is what it is. So, I mean, like, you know, once it wraps, I mean, you know, everybody else is kind of free to do whatever they want to do, basically, to, you know, go out and, you know, do things and stuff. But I mean, I have to use my free time to, like, to finish. I've got to, you know, get things done. And I mean, you know, I had to fly to Seattle for a week to edit with my friend James. And then when we did the pickup shots, when I came back, we did pickup shots, because we did a rough edit just to see what all we needed and what we're missing. And then I had to fly back for another week. And, like a month later, and do, another round of editing with him. And just since then, it's just been like, you know, and, you know, before when I was doing episode one by myself, before we brought other people in, it was, you know, I mean, I'd go to work, come home from work, I'd start editing. I'd try to knock out a trailer or something, or try to get, you know, my sequences done. And then I'd be up till late. I'd get up and go to work the next day, come back, work. You know, and I mean, I worked 6 days a week because I worked as a server at the time. So I worked four doubles and two singles every single week for 6 days a week and tried to do all this. And so it was a lot of juggling. It was a lot of stuff that nobody sees. Nobody ever knows how much work I've put into it. You know, it's been a lot of stuff. But I mean, you know, it's my baby. And I know, like, you know, I love this thing and I know John loves this thing, and I'm trying to, you know, it was also something I'm trying to get done, you know, and stuff. So it was like, you know, you got to do, you know, it's like when you own a business, you have to put that legwork in at first before you can start bringing more people and hiring, you know, employees and all that sort of stuff. You have a priority you have to do to get things done. And so, you know, I looked at it like that and just did what I needed to do. But yeah, it was just my life consisted of working and getting a lot of this done. And, you know, I mean, you know, you know, you see the end of it and you're just like, oh, this is great, you know, and it feels good to see it done. I mean, like right now I'm like today I had to watch, yesterday I had to watch the entire second episode again for like the zillionth time just so I can make any changes on sound design. And then like, you know, today I had to look at, some visual effects that came through to check those out. And so I'm constantly still like, you know, watching these episodes through this whole post, you know, production time. And I know I've seen the show like a million times, all four episodes.
Have you gotten tired of it yet?
Yes and no. I mean,
okay.
From this perspective, yeah. This perspective of it, a little bit, you know, but no, like the show is still like, I watch the show and it's still like, oh man, like I can't wait to show people this, you know, or like, you know, the trailer even, like, I'm just like, I'm still like, you know, this trailer I didn't cut. I cut the last three trailers we had. I didn't cut this trailer. Allie cut this trailer and she did just an amazing job. So props to her because she really like knocked that trailer out of the park. She did really, really good on it. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I mean, I watched the trailer, you know, and yeah, I mean, like I want to show people because I want, you know, like all the hard work that's been put into this thing, you know, like all of the work that's just been put into it and all the time put into it and all the, you know, I want people to see this thing. And so it's like, I show people and, you know, and I'm proud of it, you know, and it's weird because like, I hate watching myself. Like you know, but when you have to be that side of the production, you kind of have to, but you know, if I go to a premiere, something that I'm in, I literally, like, I just feel sick to my stomach when you know, even if somebody's like, oh man, you did so great, I'm just like, thank God that's over. I don't want to watch that again.
Yeah.
You know, I don't really like you. And I know a lot of other actors that are like that. Like Johnny Depp doesn't watch himself, and Meryl Streep doesn't watch herself.
I know a few actors personally, you know, that don't watch the films that they've done once they're finished.
It's very hard because it's hard to see it from the viewer perspective when you watch it, because you're like, I'm guessing this is why, but for me, like, I'm constantly critiquing myself. You know, if I watch it, I'm like, oh, I could have said that line different. Oh, I could have, you know, even if it was exactly what the director wanted, or everybody's like, oh man, it was so good. I'm just like, no, I could have done that totally different. You know what I mean? It's like you could critique yourself so bad. And I think everybody does that, but it's like, I can't view it the way that, you know, somebody else does. So it's a really difficult fine line when I have to, you know, do this. And John and I have already talked, and we're like, you know, the next season we do, him and I both were like, we're not going to be, we might stay on as producers, but like, we're not going to be doing as much as we did. And I'm definitely not going to be, I have had like so much, from, you know, very beginning to now to end still, just like so much invested in it, you know, work wise. And it's like, I don't want to do that again, you know, like, and he's like, nope. He's like, we're not going to, you don't have to. going to be like, basically once we get some funding and, you know, from other people besides, you know, the minuscule stuff that I put in and like the major stuff that John's put in, you know, financially, it's like once, you know, it's, then, you know, somebody else is doing that and they have more people on board, then all we want to do is get up there. I don't mind even directing, but I like that. But like, it'll be, you know, we produce on the side, we'll act and direct. And as far as editing stuff, just let somebody get some supervisors, some post supervisors, and everybody else watch this thing until it's done. And then I'll look at it, but I don't want to see, or if I'm not directing that episode, someone else is, and they'll take care of it and I don't have to do it.
Well, and it's hard. Number one, it can be hard to release your baby into other people's hands.
Yeah, that's true.
Number two, it can be hard not to be sick of your own project when you are that hip deep within the creation of something. Not that it isn't great. And a passion project, but like a prime example was, there became a point where my music with my musical partner became very taxing on my wife. And it wasn't for the presence of my musical partner. It was for the fact of we were working on music. We wrote a mass amount of music in a very short amount of time. It was crazy. In 6 months, we probably wrote the equivalent of about 5 albums worth of music. It was nuts.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's really great, though.
But working on that and doing that mass amount meant that she heard that all the time. All the time.
Oh, yeah.
All the time. And though we loved it, she got to where she didn't.
Yeah.
And just in the last few years has it gotten to where, like, I'll get in the car and, like, that music will be on the USB drive or something, and I'll be like, yeah, all right, cool. You know, like, she listens to it, and she likes it. She was just ear-tired of it. And that's what you kind of have to be careful for, is getting burned out. How do you keep from getting burned out when working on a project with this kind of longevity? I think... that's probably one of the biggest tips that we can give people. I myself, as a musician and a composer, have written things that are an hour and a half long and stuff that's like a minute, and been doing it for years. Some of it's up for sale. I've made no money. It doesn't mean I'm not going to keep making music. You know what I mean? I'm in it for the long haul. I'm an artist. If I'm like found 20 years after I'm dead, cool, enjoy the music. That's how I feel. So I don't get burned out on my projects, really. But what do you do when in a long-term project like this? How do you keep from getting burned out? How do you keep from getting like director's cramp, so to speak?
Well, I mean, the thing is, you know, you can really tell if somebody loves what they do as opposed to, you know, they're in it for the wrong reason, or they're, you know, in it for, you know, or they don't have that passion or that drive or that love for it, you know. And it's not saying if you get burnt out that you don't, but it, you know, because I mean, at some point, you know, I mean, I got burnt out with music at one point, just from like the replacing all the band members at some,
sure.
you know, and then you have to get them, when you're doing original music, you have to get them to learn all the stuff again. It's not like everyone's like, oh yeah, I know that cover song and play, you know, but then you have to learn it, and you, they have to learn everything. You have to get tight again before you do shows. And that's the fun part of the shows. So it's like, you know, so it doesn't mean you don't love it, but it's like, cause everybody gets burned out. But at the same time, like if, you know, and I was told one time, like if you absolutely love something, you know, you're going to pursue, it's just like a marriage. You know, if you love it, you're going to pursue through those hard times. You're going to push through, you know, and I'm speaking from a non-married guy, but sure. You know, I know that concept, and I know like my friends that are married and I've heard it.
You know what you're supposed to do, like, when you get married.
That's right. That's right. Ladies, are you listening? No. So, you know, but like, yeah, I mean, if you love somebody, you're going to like push through that, sure. You know, and even through the hard times. And that's the same thing with this. Like when you love something, you know, you're going to push. And that's like the true testament also of like, you know, do you really love what you're doing? Because sure. Like, you know, a year and a half ago, I could have been like, oh my gosh, this is, you know, this is, I can't do this no more. You know, I have other projects I want to get on, because I do have other projects that I want to do. And, you know, and I mean, my life has been like a nonstop work. It feels like I've done, you know, because if I'm not working, it's like, you know, on set or doing whatever, I'm doing this stuff. If I'm not doing this stuff, I'm doing other films or hired to do another film or working on a script or whatever. And so it's been a constant work. So I could easily get burned out, but it's like, I don't, because I love this stuff so much. Like I love doing it. But, you know, at the same time, like if you get that moment, you know, where you feel like you're burnt out, or you feel like, oh, you're like, oh my gosh, this is, you know, I got it, whatever. The best thing I think to do, and what I've done before, is step away from it. Step away from it for like just a few days or a week. You know, I mean, you don't step away from it a long time. Just a few days, or step away from it for a week. And then when you see it again, you know, it'll be like a newfound love. You know, I mean, you appreciate the work again, as opposed to, you know, how much, you know, you've seen it every day. And yep. So that helps me, because, you know, I'll step away from it, you know, if I have to. Like, I'll be like, okay, I just need like 3 days of not messing with that at all. And I'll work on something else to work my creativity, to just give me another outlet, and to, you know, getting excited again. And then when I go back and watch it, it's like, you know, it's like seeing it again for the first time, because I've stepped away for a few days. I'm so used to seeing it every day.
Yeah.
And so that's one thing. And then like, you know, I love the whole character thing with it. So it's like, it gets exciting, you know, trying to see it from that perspective helps me stay excited as well. And, you know, when new things happen with it, like if, you know, oh, okay, we're almost done with visual effects, you kind of get that jolt of a child in a candy store or whatever again. You're just like, oh, we're almost there. We're done with visual effects now or whatever. So that helps too. When you push through a next phase, you know, it really helps, because you're that much closer to it. And, yeah, I mean, that's just, that for me has been like a big, big thing. It's just, you know, take a couple days off, step away from it. You know, even when you write a script, that's one of the things that I learned too. When you write a script, that somebody was telling me, they're like, don't do your second draft right away. Finish your first draft, step away from it for a week, so you got new clear eyes on it, and then start writing again.
Yep.
And that's what it was for me with writing, with songs as well. Like, you know, there's like, if I hear my music now, I could be tired of it. And this is a perfect example. You're a musician, so when you listen to your music and you hear it every day, you're going to get tired of hearing it every day. But if you step back from it and then you listen to it again, then it's like hearing it for the first time. But the thing about that is, for me personally, it's like when I've not heard anything I've done, which I don't listen to it very often, so it'll be almost a year before I hear anything I've done again, music-wise. But like, you know, when I hear it again, it's not necessarily the music or the song that gets me excited. It's the fact that I'm like, oh my gosh, I miss doing that. I miss playing. I miss being on stage. I miss that.
Sure.
That's a good way of looking at the film thing too. When I step away from, you know, this creative thing with Death and Compromise or the post-production or whatever, when I see it again, I'm just like, oh, like I miss being on set. When can John and I and the rest of the cast and crew get back on set and do it again? And that's where I get my excitement that comes back.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, that's very much the same for me, as a musician. It's something that I always told musicians that I provided live recordings to was don't listen to this on your way home tonight.
Yeah.
Like, listen to it tomorrow. Number one, you've probably had a couple drinks. And the idea behind you buying these CDs from me on, like, I could always tell the people that watched the live DVDs that I sold them for $25, because after they bought like three or four of them, you know, and the way I sold it to them was like, think about it like high school football, you know, the coach always has some guy up there videotaping so he can watch the game later. You should be doing the same thing. You can literally see how your crowd reacts to things that you're doing on stage. And I could tell the bands that did that because after two or three DVD purchases, somebody in the band would drop a microphone from the stage. I'd go to set up and the bassist would be like, oh, no, I don't need that anymore. No. The guys have been telling me for years that I make an ass out of myself whenever I drink on the microphone, and they're absolutely correct. I don't need to have that.
Yeah.
And it was like, oh, nice. You use them for what they're used for. But it was also one of those, like, give yourself a rest. Enjoy what you did tonight. Come back and listen to it later, and you'll have totally fresh ears. And that's the same idea, to come back even a few months later, and not necessarily to make tweaks in anything in Death and Compromise, but to make notes for the next season, to make notes for the next shoot, everything else. Like, hey, I noticed that we could probably do this a little bit different. And doing things like that are majorly important for the development, for the growth of a production in general.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And everything's a learning process. You know, I mean, if you don't take something away with it, then you're not doing enough. You need to do something else. Cause you know, I mean, there's things that on any set I've ever been on, Death and Compromise, Lasting Moments, or anything that, you know, I've worked on where it's like, you know, where I've learned stuff where I'm like, you know, I would do that differently next time. Or, you know, the minute you stop learning stuff is the minute you're done. It doesn't matter. Like if you're, you know, Tom Cruise or Angelina Jolie or whoever you are, you're constantly learning and honing your craft and doing stuff.
Learning a new limitation that you personally have. I have said that for years about the live AV industry, that if you're not learning something every day on the job, whether it's a faster way to set up a projection screen, something, a different way to go through the same hotel that you've been in 100 times. You know, like whatever. If you're not looking to learn something every day while you're on the job, you're wasting some of your time.
Absolutely. Yeah. Expand your limitations too.
And
get out of that comfort zone. That's the thing too. Get out of that comfort zone.
Yeah. Yeah. Most definitely. Most definitely. With that in mind, as we get ready to wrap up here, what are a couple, give us two pieces of advice that you have for, one piece of advice for an upcoming producer, and a piece of advice for an upcoming director, because they're two very different hats to wear that work very close together.
Yes. So I would say just at the beginning, just in general, just, you know, don't ever give up, because it doesn't matter. You know, the only people that don't do something with their passion or with their career or whatever are the people who don't either put the time into it, don't put the work into it, or they just give up way too early, you know, before they get there. Because, you know, I've seen singers who don't have great voices, you know, that, you know, keep pushing and pushing and pushing. And it's just something about their voice and their persona or their determination that, you know, that make you listen, you know, and nobody starts off, you know, out of the bat doing great. So don't compare yourself to people. Cause I did get in that one time where, you know, where I had a hard time, you know, cause I compared myself to, you know, how come, you know, this isn't as good as, you know, this person can do or whatever. And that's just a really bad thing to fall into. Don't compare yourself to people, because everybody's in different, you know, does things differently and stuff. So I would tell people that, just don't do that. Just you are your own creative, you know, outlet. Do it the way you do it, and, you know, it'll be great. So definitely don't give up. Just, you can do anything you want to do. You just put your mind to it. You do it, and you have to put in the work. It's not going to come to you in the middle of the night. You wake up and go, oh, you know, here I am in Hollywood. And with that being said, that should never be your goal. I mean, you can have that as a goal, but that should never be your primary focus, I should say.
Yeah.
Your focus should be on the passion of the art, the love for it. Like me personally, I have goals and I have things that I want to reach and stuff like that. And, you know, even for music, it was, you know, I wanted to be on stage with Poison, with Bret Michaels. And I got to, and I kept that goal, and I did it twice. I opened up for him twice when I was playing music.
Nice. But
that wasn't my only primary focus. My focus was, I played shows, whether I got paid for it, whether they were free, it didn't matter. I played because I loved to play. And that's the thing with this, like, my goal, or, you know, my focus is not getting in Hollywood. My focus is nothing to do with that. My focus is not living in a mansion. My focus is not having tons of cars or, you know, ton of money or women or whatever. That, I have no desire for any of that stuff. And I do this because I love doing this. And if you chase the dream, what your heart, you know, desires and stuff for that, you know, and then the rest of that will come as it's supposed to, you know, I don't care if I make $1 million. If I can make $300,000 a year and do this the rest of my life and love this stuff, and live in, you know, an okay house, that's my goal, is to act and direct and write the rest of my life as a career to sustain myself and be able to have a healthy, enjoyable life. And, you know, so that's a thing. And I'm a Christian, so it's like, you know, I know that, you know, that, like Denzel Washington put it one way, so that gut feeling in your stomach, where you want to do something so bad and you love this so much, is like God's way of saying, this is yours, but you have to go work for it. You have to go get it.
Yep.
This is your passion. This is your drive. You have to put the work into it. And so, and I believe if you chase your dreams, you know, the rest of it, God will provide, it'll happen for you. That's my biggest thing, is there. That's, you know, make sure your focus is right.
You
know, because that's what's going to get you where you want to be.
Yeah. You either chase your dreams or your dreams chase you. One of the two.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah, pretty much. So, and then with a director, I'd say, you know, learn as much as you can, you know, study with people, you know, not only school wise. I never did none of that stuff. John never went to school, none of that stuff or anything like that. Just, you know, learn it, like get on set, work with people. When you're on set, watch what people do, you know, ask questions. But again, there's a time to ask questions. Don't ask questions when you're in the middle of you know, someone's like, action.
Yeah.
You're like, hey, so what? Don't do that. And if they're in the middle of the day, don't, you know, do it then either, because it gets hectic. But, you know, but learn. I mean, ask questions, you know, learn it. Storyboarding is a big, big thing, you know, with directing too. We did a little bit of storyboarding with Death and Compromise. The DP and myself, because he also was an artist. So, you know, when I'd go to his house and we would you know, he would sketch some stuff out that I told him I was looking for and things like that. And we would make, you know, just, we didn't storyboard the whole thing. So, you know, I do recommend storyboarding. It's very important. You know, don't, and here's a director saying that you don't, your character, your actor out of character if you don't have to.
Yeah.
Like, leave him in character, because it's much easier to leave him in character and talk to him as a character to get what you want from that person than to be like, you know, okay, Bill, here's, you know, what I need you to do. You remember when you're, you know, just try to keep them in character when you're doing that scene. And if you're on a short budget, do your angles at the same time. Like, jump from one, you know, one over the shoulder to the other over the shoulder, and get them both while they're in character before you yell cut. Because, you know, after you yell cut, an actor's sitting there going, they're thinking about what they just did. They're thinking about, you know.
Yeah, they've turned their switch off.
Yeah, exactly. So then you have to give them a moment, you know, to get back in there and stuff. And so really, the more you can keep your actors in character, the better it's going to be for them personally, and the better it's going to be for you for what you want to get. So that's something that I've also learned as well, and, you know, and worked with and try to do, is just keep them, you know, in character as much as possible. So storyboarding, keep your actors in character. You know, just, and treat everybody good. There's no reason to be, you know, one of those directors that's like, you know, oh, you're not, you know, just, you know, you're having fun. This is your set. You know, this is your day. This is your, you know, your whole crew is together, your friends, your, you know, or you should be friends at least. And, you know, this is what you love to do. Don't make it miserable, because then you're not going to want to do it. So make it fun, you know, let everybody have a good time, but work diligently and get your work done too. And so that's the biggest thing I say for directing. And then producing, you know, make sure you get your all the ends tightened up. The producer essentially is going to be, and there's different, you know, different producers, you know, that do different things, but, you know, a producer has to oversee a lot of different aspects. You have a lot of work, you know, but, you know, you have to make sure everything's, you know, tied together, and just, so just be, you know, mindful of what you got to do. You do a lot of the hiring of the head departments, and then the head departments are going to be, you know, hiring under them for the most part. But, you know, you also have to overlook all the, you know, the budgeting and all of the, you know, marketing stuff. And, you know, so just do your homework, get, you know, what you know. Again, ask questions, learn, you know, get on set with other producers. I mean, just even if you can get on as their assistant to help them or whatever, to learn the different things. I mean, you can Google anything, be like, what does a producer do? You know, how can I get better at producing? You know, what are my primary jobs? You know, anything, you know, to learn. I mean, the first time I went on the set as a PA, you know, and I didn't know, I had been a PA on like smaller things, like independent stuff. But the first time I went onto a major motion picture as a PA that had like, I mean, like A-list celebrities and all kinds of stuff on it, I didn't know. I was like, I mean, I wanted to know what I needed to do, because I knew from a smaller level what I needed to do as a PA. So I had to get on. I Googled it.
Yeah.
Like the week before I was getting on set, I Googled this stuff to learn, because that's the biggest thing that we have in our corners. We can learn, and Google is so big on teaching you things. You know, video. It's like on YouTube where people are like, "This is the life of a PA," you know, and just by Googling that, you know, like, you know, I thought I knew, you know, a lot of what a PA did, but I knew I didn't know exactly what a PA did. And I didn't want to get on some major motion picture and look like a fool and go, you know, like I want to at least know the bare minimum to know what I need to do to make sure that I didn't overlook anything, you know.
Yeah, like you can't completely fake it till you make it.
Yeah, exactly. You can learn the minimum and get on there, and you can fake the rest of it and you learn stuff that day. But like, you know, I didn't at the time didn't know what echoing was. And so, like, you know, and I mean, it's been a little while now, but like, I, you know, I know all this stuff now, but it's like, you know, I didn't at the time when I did my first PA job on a big set. And so like, I didn't know what echoing was. And so, you know, it was telling us all the, you know, on the Google thing I looked up, it was telling me all the different, you know, phrases. And that's the thing too, working on a film set, there's a lot of terms you need to learn. I bet, like, a ton of people don't know what a stinger is. A stinger is just an extension cord is all it is. But people might be like, can you look me that stinger over there? Or, you know, people might be like,
And we spot you film dudes the minute that you walk on to our job site in the corporate or theater world, because you call it a stinger, we call it an Edison cable.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, see what happened over these terms.
Most folks just call it an extension cord.
Exactly. We don't know who's right, but you know, they all work the same. So.
But you will get the collective eye roll so large that you can hear it. You know, you can hear people's eyes rolling at the same time whenever you call it by the wrong name. Like, ooh, I felt that.
Right. Or even somebody knows, you know. Yeah, or even if somebody asked you to do it, you have no clue. Like, I remember getting on set that day when I did it the first time. I was like, any big picture of the PA. I remember getting on there, and I had read those terms because I Googled those terms, and like you know, the PA terms or whatever and stuff. And it was like, you know, brick is a battery for a walkie. And if I hadn't Googled that the day, like, they use these terms on set. So it's like the first thing that I walked in that door, and they were like, all right, go grab yourself a battery, a headset, and a brick, and have some couple bricks on you. And if I hadn't known that term before I got there, I'd have been like, what do I need bricks for? I got to throw them at somebody? What do I need bricks for? You know, I would have known it was a battery. So I highly recommend learning the jargon and just learn as much as you can. Like, I still learn to this day. Like, I always learn something new. I try to. I want to learn as much as I can. You know, I want to know how to do everything. So, because you make yourself more accessible. The more you know how to do on a film set, the more you're going to be a commodity. Because then people can be like, well, I don't have a PA role available, but can you AC? Sure, I've done AC before. Well, now you have a job that you wouldn't have had if you didn't know how to do multiple things.
Yep.
So
precisely. You know, always be willing to grow outside of your skill set, folks.
Yes, absolutely.
And thank you so much for taking the time to come on, talk about the creation of Death and Compromise, talk about what it is to be a writer, director, producer, to wear all these different hats within the industry. Let everybody out there know where they can go to find out more information, where they can go to support the effort for Death and Compromise Season 2. It's shameless plug time. Go for it, Brian.
All right. So absolutely. You can get on IMDb. It's imdb.com, and you can look up Death and Compromise. We are on that, as well as you can go to Facebook. And the easy way to do Facebook is just facebook.com/DeathAndCompromise. And that's all spelled out, not the and symbol, but the Death and Compromise on Facebook. And we're on there. You can tweet us with hashtags all you want with Death and Compromise. You can get on, there's a YouTube page. It's Elder Films, or if you put in Brian Elder Music after youtube.com/, it'll take you there, or you can just look on YouTube for Elder Films. That'll take you to a YouTube page that has some trailers up there. You can go to, let's see, where else can you go? I mean, and you can look any of us up too if you want to reach out for anything. You have some questions. None of us mind helping out. It's Brian Elder with an I, John Hall. You know, and I also want to shout out to Josh Hatfield. He came on as a writer as well. So Josh Hatfield, Jeremiah Oldsman, you know, some of the actress Andrea Flowers and Michael J. Rodriguez. He played the sheriff, Chad Thaxton, Jennifer Kendall. There's James Janda, Holly Holland, Justin Durbin, Troy Romo. I mean, there's so many people on this thing, and, you know, so many people helping. So all of us are willing to help out any way we can, you know, if you have questions or anything. So, yeah, ask away, find us, check out Elder Films, Death and Compromise, and the film festival John and I are running, Elder Hall, Texas Independent Film Festival. So, and we will be doing a premiere, so keep checking the Facebook page. We're going to be doing a limited premiere of the entire season, one night only. Only limited to, we haven't decided if we're doing 94 seater theater or 141, but it's only going to be a limited time, ooh, one night only for the entire season.
Ooh, I got to be there for that.
So, yes.
Well,
yes, we will be posting that on the page, and we'll be selling tickets between $5 to $10, but it'll be only, and that way we know when to cap it off.
Yeah.
That's okay. We're sold out.
Great. Great. Cannot wait. Well, please do hold the line. Once again, thank you so much for coming on. Brian, ladies and gentlemen, actor, writer, director, producer of the fantastic series Death and Compromise. Please do go check everything out, like you said, online. Keep your ears out in the world for that. Keep your ears out for the announcement. Once we hear about it, we'll let you know on the Facebook group for Talking Sound. Of course, while you're online checking out the great work of Brian Elder and the series Death and Compromise, please do stop on by TalkingSoundShow.com. That is where you can find all of the episodes. That's where you can find the industry news section. It's where you can find the freelance database. If you're a freelancer like me looking to find work around the country, go check it out. Whole listing of companies there that hire freelance AV technicians. While you're online, please do make sure to stop on by and check out our parent network, the HC Universal Network. That is hcuniversalnetwork.com. Until next time, everybody, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and take care of your hearing. Keep reaching for 11. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.